All right, folks, welcome back to the flagstick.com Tea Talk podcast, my favorite podcast. It's the only one I do each week. Stefan Tiedorf here with my co-host, Scott McLeod. Scotty, how are you?
I'm doing great, bud. How are you?
I'm doing okay. Played a little golf this weekend. What about you?
Yeah, I got a few holes in. I tried to play 18 on Saturday. Unfortunately, I was a single and I got jammed up against a bunch of other golfers. So it lasted three holes for me. I just figured that was enough. It was too slow. It was a nice effort. Just wasn't
a single
work.
On a Saturday. You're 50 years old. You've been playing golf for 40 years and you thought that was going to work.
Well, I thought maybe I could hit a few shots and take my time. But I also didn't really come to the understanding that Saturday afternoons now, there's a lot of novice golfers that are out playing. Mm-hmm. And you know what? I don't want to be pressuring them and I don't want to be trying to play through them or whatever. And that was fine. I got it in. But I snuck out yesterday, got in 18. It was a random pairing. I got paired with a nice young guy out of Ottawa who turned out used to play the PGA of Ottawa Junior Tour back in the day. And turned out to be a great pairing and we enjoyed ourselves. And we probably have another podcast listener out of it too.
There we go. I think I got a couple this week. I'm not going to say it went viral, but like one of my first tweets where it's like, I'm getting pings left, right, and center. I mean, pings, tweets, thinking of Slack here. That's work mode. Tweets left, right, and center. People arguing with me. Some guy was trying to argue with me about what caddies make. And he's like, no, you don't get a percentage if unless you're top three. I was like, oh really? I didn't know that.
Yeah, well,
welcome, I learned, I guess. Yeah.
Welcome to social media. Yeah. I mean, turn your notifications off.
I should have. Yeah, but I played a little golf this weekend. I know on this podcast I've talked about having the driver yips for a while and like finally, you know, feel comfortable off the tee, feel like irons, you got this small swing change really working, feel like I'm hitting the ball better than ever. In the last two rounds, respectively, I've had 35 and 36 putts and not a single three putt in those two rounds. Wow. So the club that has saved me for probably my entire golfing career has decided, you know what, I'm going to take a break. I've carried this whole contraption for years and I'm done with you. And now I can't putt anymore. So what are your thoughts?
Guess you gotta work on your putting.
I guess so. I don't know, something's up.
I mean I guess that's the thing. I mean, everybody becomes so obsessed with their golf swing. Mm-hmm. And I see it all the time as a coach. I mean, I can tell you anytime that you know, somebody contacts me, usually their first thing they want to work on is something in their golf swing. Mm-hmm. They don't think about their short game, they don't think about their putting. But you know, just in the last week or so, preparing some junior players for you know, the Ontario Championships and stuff like that, you know, they begin to realize and understand how important it is and how much more time they should actually be spending on that versus their full swing and, you know, how it's going to actually save them a lot more strokes. But, you know, the full swing is sexy. That's why everybody wants to have this perfect golf swing, but you need to work on a lot more than that.
I just think it's when you can't get the ball off the ground or you're like hitting shanks or hitting big slices, like that's just so much more frustrating that people just don't care. Right. Like when you go to like, if you can get the ball in the air, you're hitting the ball well, you can go to like Topgolf and have fun and everything. Yeah. If all you can do is putt, well, like, you know, well, it's going to take a while there. And then by the time you get to the hole, you're annoyed anyway. You might not even putt that much.
Well, the thing is, people would probably spend more time on putting if they hit putts out of bounds.
Yeah, that's true. You know what I mean? That's true. I have seen it before. You know, the guy that putts off the green in the water. Those are always the tough ones to watch.
For sure.
I shout out to Scott Fawcett, set me up with a full Decade app to check out their stuff. He's been helping out some caddies with that type of stuff, which I guess I am. Still, I don't know. He doesn't listen to podcasts.
Alumni
counts. I'm going to do some McKenzie Tour events, I think, at some point. So I wanted to check out their you know, the yardage book features and stuff like that. But one of the big things was, you know, with putting, his thoughts are speed is the most important thing, right? Like people get so caught up in the line and your actual stroke and all this type of stuff. And he kind of used the example of most people, if you grabbed like, you know, the standard 7 foot putting mat, right? And you're down on your carpet. Most people, you got them out to that 7 feet away. they're going to make, you know, 50 of those in a row, right? Your stroke is probably fine. But you bring them out to the course and you give them a straight 7-footer and it's not necessarily the same thing because there's never really a straight one and the speed's all different and everything like that. And there's just a bunch of different speed drills. So I'm thinking I'm going to just, that's going to be my only thing I focus on. We're going tomorrow to play Beacon Hall. We cannot wait. We've only heard amazing things. And that's all I'm thinking about. I'm going to get on that putting green. I'm just going to dial in that speed because I'm elite that way. We're going to have a great round. We can't wait to go out and play with Jason and Mitch tomorrow from Titleist.
Yeah, it should be fun.
All right. You want to hit the week that was, Scotty?
Yeah, let's get right to it.
All right, big week. Obviously, the Evian Championship was this week and was able to catch a bit of that. Where do you want to start this week? You want to start with your birdie then?
Yeah, sure. Why not? You know, obviously, Minji Lee getting the win there. Big for her. It's still kind of weird, though. It's a major, and 675 is the first prize. And, you know, they go all the way to France for that. And, you know, I get it. I'm sure they're grateful to have a major championship and have a great sponsor. But, you know, you're always thinking major should be more money. But Minji, you know, 7-stroke comeback and to get the win there, obviously gets her first major. Big birdie to her for that of just coming back. You know, it might have been a little disappointing in the end. And I'm sure we'll get to that when you talk about a couple things here. But a big birdie for her. Obviously, a very talented player, her brother winning 2 weeks ago at the Scottish Open as well. Their dad, you know, a golf coach. Just big for her, big for everybody in Australia. A number of friends over there were pretty excited, leading into obviously a lot more things, hopefully for her and more wins as well. It was quite kind of expected that at some point she would definitely be getting a major, and it was nice to see her finally get that.
Yeah, finally gets the first one. Australian golf is just on fire right now, and that might be. Might a little hint to our next segment. We're going to do our top three. We're not going to go like, hey, this guy's winning gold, this lady's winning bronze. We're just going to top three. No. I think it's too difficult to get there. Yeah. And we're never going to get that right. Just a little hint to when we get there. I might be looking Australia's way here, Scotty. There are Australians on fire. Cam Davis, obviously, you're talking about her brother here with Minji Lee. Just playing well. They're playing good golf and they're winning, and Australia loves their golf. And shout out to Luke Elvey, kind of always highlighting that on Twitter of like, hey, look out for these guys. Like Cam Davis forever. He was like,
yeah,
you know, believe in this kid. He's going to get there. He's getting close. And he really talks about Australian golf, even though he's Australian, living a Canadian in Canada, working in America. This guy's all over the place, but still knows his roots. I like the Evian Championship. I don't know. It didn't like bring me in though. I tried watching earlier in the week and I just was not excited. When I was watching the US Open, the women's US Open a few weeks ago or a month ago now, like I was excited from day one. Like I was in there. I liked the course. I obviously know that course better. And I just really wasn't excited. And I don't think I got that excited. And I kind of went back and forth, but I threw on the back nine on Sunday and it got interesting. And they, you know, you have to battle back and everything. And Jung Lee Six obviously needed that birdie on 18 just to get into the playoff. Was it Minji Lee that needed the birdie?
Yeah, Minji Lee.
Right. Sorry, my bad. It was a grind out there. And then you get to a playoff. And you know, you're Jung Lee Six, you'd pipe it down the middle.
Yeah.
And then yeah, like it was like I hit that iron.
Yeah, and she said it too. That shot was terrible.
Like, yeah, it was the thinnest shot in right away. So I'm giving her my honorable mention bogey for the week because she made bogey in a playoff when you know, Minji Lee had that 10-footer for Eagle to win. She had at that point she got a 3-putt for par and picks up her. It's kind of
anticlimactic, really.
Yeah, like because you thought the playoff, you know, they're in there. You make birdie to get in the playoff, and hopefully, you know, we get some more. Yeah. And maybe, you know, I wasn't ready for what we've got on the PGA Tour lately with the 5 and 8 hole playoffs, but like wouldn't have mind more than one hole, I guess. I just don't love that finishing hole. No. Like, what is a 455 yard par 5?
Yeah, and I think
it's just too short.
Yeah, and I think part of it too is that, you know, there's such low scoring on that golf course. Obviously, they ended up with a 61 during the week, one of the other players, and you sort of expect the playoff then to be a, you know, Eagle does beat birdie, or you know what I mean?
Especially with it was Jung Lee Six, he shot that 61, right? Like, she's dialed in. She's been dialed in all week, and then goes from 61 to, I think, she's even par on Sunday to get in that playoff.
So it just sort of fizzled, unfortunately. So, and I think players too were, you know, they were eyeing up other things. They're trying to get out of there and get their way to Japan and, you know, all sorts of other stuff as well. And obviously it's a scenic golf course. I think, you know, we'll have this conversation again another time. There's still a lot of discussion about, you know, the five majors that are on the women's side and, you know, do they need five? Are they the right five? And all sorts of different things. And that's come up again lately as well. And I think it always comes up every year when the Avion is on.
Yeah. And that's the one I believe Stacey Lewis kind of refuses to go to, if I'm not mistaken, because she's like, it's not a major. They don't treat it like a major. They don't pay us like a major. I'm not going there. Right. So when it's that, when you got the top players in your game not showing up to a major, probably a tough look. And I know a lot of them weren't going because of the Olympics this week, which, you know, there was flight issues, there were visa issues, there was COVID issues to get there. So it wasn't the strongest field they've had. But I mean, speaking of weird, not strong fields, did I just see there was an 82-year-old woman playing in the senior women's
Open? Of course there is. Joanne Carner. I mean, Joanne Carner, you know, a few years ago shot her age there. It's not just any woman, it's Joanne Carner. She's,
I understand. Yeah, it's a radio show, Scott. I had to like line you up for that.
she's won five US Opens. You know, she deserves to be there. She's just a cool character, the great Guinea. I mean, I posted the picture with her with a drink. I could have posted one with her with a drink and a smoke as well. Yeah.
Which I love. Yeah. I love that. But like for you, like what is she going to shoot? Like, is she going to break 80 or break 90? Like,
she'll be in the low 80s. But I mean, again, she earned it. She got her spot in there. And I don't think any of the other players, I mean, especially for the U.S. senior.
She earned her way in, or is the U.S. senior open for the women? Like, if you win, you get in for a lifetime.
Yeah, well, she's exempt from her past status of other events. I mean, she's won 8 USGA events. So, you know, that's how she worked her way in there. But yeah, there's 4 Canadians in there as well. But I mean, yeah, you know what? You've got the young ones that are going in there, which would be Annika, who's obviously playing in it this year. And you got the other end of the spectrum of the great Gundy, which was her nickname early on. But Joanne Carner, yeah, she's just a character. And I think all the other players will enjoy her being there. And I don't think anybody's going to really be upset by her being in the field there in Connecticut this week.
No, probably not. I'm just thinking, like, can you imagine it happening? Like, you don't see that on the men's.
She'll beat people.
Oh, she's going to beat people. No, the women, I feel the women's game celebrates those stories and encourages that a little bit more, that fun side of things in these big tournaments than the men's game. The only time you see it in the men's game is really at the Masters when you get Sandy Lyle out there in his overalls. But like outside of that, you don't see it, but people love watching it. So I don't know. Maybe I'm the stickler here. I guess
it's having some ceremonial golfers in there. And I think it's a sort of antithesis of what you're talking about, of how everything has gotten very businesslike. You know, and we'll get to who are our guests this week. But one of the things that he mentions in the interview is talking about how the tours have changed over the years and how things used to be even 20 years ago. There was a lot more fun of different things that were involved, and he understands the progression that's there, but you know, now it's more of a business. So in this case, the USGA is really celebrating the game, and it does provide them that opportunity in this US Senior Women's Open, which has only been around for a few years, you know, to have champions like that in the field.
Why don't you give a quick breakdown of our guest this week and kind of the stuff you talked about quickly? Because I think it transitions into my bogey this week really well.
Yeah, so Stuart Anderson, who's a four-time winner on the Canadian Tour, won the Tour Championship a couple times, turned pro back in 2001. And, you know, he's had quite the career, and he's getting back to the game. He's a player who was well-known as a party guy and then, you know, was very public about, you know, giving up drinking and how it made a big transition in his life and made a change in his life. And he knew he had to do it, but he could still be fun. You know, it was the best decision he said he made in his life. And I think people will be engaged by his story if they don't know it. And the fact that, you know, he's still in love with the game, he's still doing all sorts of different things with the game, which you'll hear about in the interview, I think are really important. But he put the responsibility on himself to make that decision, which I think leads into your bogey this week.
Yeah, my bogey for this week is on the I'm giving it to the pip, and the reason why I'm giving it to the pip is there's more stories like Grayson Murray's story on the PGA Tour that will never get told. Mm-hmm. And the story comes out in his tweet where he talks about, being an alcoholic on the PGA Tour, and getting fined for being drunk in a hotel lobby that had nothing to do with the PGA Tour, and getting fined instead of actually going on to help him with that situation, saying, you know what, like, hey, you're not representing the tour well, but like, what's going on? Are you okay? And I think people don't really understand. There's probably way more stories like this, like Stu said, where, you know, guys are drinking because they're lonely out there. The travel life is not for everyone. No. There's always the old jokes about the caddies, being the drunks or the party guys. And it is an old joke, but it's also at the same time, a lot of these guys had no money growing, like for especially the long-term guys that caddied in the early 80s and the 90s, and they're grinding it out, right? Yeah. That this is kind of what they did, right? Like they stayed together, they drank together, and like these habits come up quick. And I think my bogey to the pip is that 40 million that you're giving for these fake social media stuff and everything along those lines could be better suited to actually take care of your players. And I'm not blaming the PGA Tour. Grayson Murray said in the tweet, the PGA Tour didn't make me an alcoholic.
Right.
But like when you do recognize people have a problem, mm-hmm. do better than just, hey, let's give Bryson DeChambeau $10 million for being an idiot for the last year in interviews and everything.
Yeah, I think the only thing that sort of comes into play there is you have to understand the PGA Tour is an organization of the members. The members own the tour. So a lot of the responsibility is not only for the tour, as we say, from a corporate side of it. It comes down to the Players Council and what the players will support and what the players want to have in their, in their mandate and in their programs and things they do. Got to understand then there's a balance there between, and I'm not saying they're doing it intentionally, but there's a balance there of providing support for players and let's just say it, pushing other players out. I mean, you got to think about it as far as the Players Council, they're going to take care of certain top players. They're going to make things better for the top players. They're not necessarily having a prerogative and you don't see any, a lot of lower end players on that Players Council. They're taking care of the players that are out there all the time. Anybody that's on the fringe or for some reason, maybe they're struggling in some way. I don't know if there's necessarily the support mechanisms that are there for them. There are some things that are there, but again, it's a really independent type of activity where it's really placed upon that, on the athlete themselves to take care of things, which can be very difficult. So I'm not saying they don't need to be more supportive. Obviously, any type of sports organization, if they have people that are members and they want those people to represent them, they certainly have to provide some support mechanism, but it's a two-way street as well. The people do have to recognize that, sometimes they have some responsibility for themselves, even if they do have an issue.
Yeah, but the only other side of things, and maybe I don't know about corporate laws and employment laws in the United States, but in Canada, if I have an employee that works for me and they come to me and they say, hey, I need help, I have a drug abuse problem, sure, an alcohol problem, it doesn't matter their performance, what they bring money wise, I gotta take care of them, right? And I understand golf's a meritocracy, but doing the right thing for people should never be about, hey, how much money is this person bringing?
But is that person a freelancer? Or are they actually an employee? And in this case, we're talking about freelancers. We're talking about people that are not employees. So that's the difficult side of it. Of yes, they want everything possible out of those people, and they obviously want to make sure that the tour itself is getting the most amount of great publicity out of these players. But on the other side of it, if they're not doing anything for the tour, it's very easy for the tour to turn their back on them. So I would say there's definitely some cracks there that people will fall through. And certainly knowing some players over the years that have fell through those cracks, probably could be some better support mechanisms that are beyond just trying to make the tour look good. You can make the tour look good by being better to people as well.
Yeah. And I think we can come to agreement on that is that they are freelancers, but do you want the best freelancers out there, or do you want to potentially lose somebody? Like, I don't know Grayson Murray's game enough. I don't know how bad, you know, his problem is that maybe, you know, he got to the PGA Tour and he's a good golfer. He made almost $300,000 this year. And he's, you know, on probably one of the worst stretches he's been on with a couple WDs and, you know, 8 missed cuts or something like that of the last 10 events or whatever it is, 9 of the last 11, whatever it is, right? Like, who knows? This guy could be a superstar for all we know, but maybe we're not taking care of a 27-year-old kid, right? Like, and that's crazy to also think, like, you know, at 27, I thought I was probably a kid too, right? And like, it's just there's just so many ways to look at it.
It's a complex subject for certain.
It is, and I just think you're gonna get more. Like, think about things outside of just making more money, and I think that's what the PIP is designed for. And putting that $40 million elsewhere into things like this, into, you know, insurance policies for caddies, things like health insurance for people like that. I think that's a much better way to spend that money. It might not come back in profits for the business that we get. Maybe that's what they're focused on, but it's hard to see, I guess.
Hopefully they recognize that, and then, you know, maybe in some way, you know, it pushes them to look at it more. And certainly, you know, we've seen some players reach out, but we've also seen some players reach out and say, hey, I didn't get that, you know, support from the tour either. So it's going to reflect a little bit of a mirror on them, and I'm certainly sure they're going to have a look at it.
I think the problem is you and I know of players that did, and then it's all swept under the rug,
that,
and
now that happens
secret
too.
Stories that you're sworn to secrecy on, and you don't get to talk about on podcasts. So that's the unfortunate part. All right, we've started with bogeys. You started hot. I took it down and then kept it down. Let's just keep it down and then let's bring it back.
Sure,
what's your bogey for the week?
Bogey for the week is TBC Twin Cities. I mean, I try to watch on this tournament, the 3M Open. The biggest thing they started talking about all the time and almost bragging about nonstop was golf balls in the water and the fact that they had 27 water hazards on the golf course. I'm sorry, but
they needed a name for it, like the bear trap.
Yeah,
right?
But I mean, I wouldn't want the reputation for my tournament to be the fact that, you know, you get the most balls in the water. You know, you could see players were frustrated. There was obviously some high numbers, especially on that last hole. And it sort of kind of taints the play of the players. I get it. It's a player's responsibility to keep the ball out of the water. But I don't think that should be the key defense to most golf courses, is, you know, having 27 lakes that are on there. So it was just a bit of a bogey for me, because, I mean, that's great. You've got some nice drama of some players trying to hit balls out of the water and different things. And it was great for Cameron Champ to get a win. Certainly it's a guy I've supported, even though he hasn't played great of late, but turned it around. But I just think the course itself kind of turned me off, which is just unfortunate, because I was really hoping it was going to be a fun event to watch.
Yeah. What do you do on 18 there? Right.
Like, I don't know. Like, I mean, hit a bunch of 9 irons. I don't know.
it's just a weird hole. I just don't know. Like, 'cause the water's not far up the right. Like, I would guess it's at probably that 250 mark. Like,
yeah.
And then left.
Where everybody was dropping all the time.
Yeah, exactly.
And then trying to smash it again from there, because they figured, oh, well, I may as well go for it here now. And, you know, I watch players like Adam Hadwin struggle. There's a few players that all of a sudden, they're left with that long shot, and they just pip, smash 3 wood from there and hope they get on.
And then left where you end up where Cameron Champ was, right? Like, you're in those trees, and then I don't know. It's a TPC awkward course. What do you expect? That's kind of where my head is at.
Yeah, pretty much.
Outside of Sawgrass and, you know, the other ones that we kind of enjoy, unfortunately it's become more of the norm, but they're built for, you know, championships. They're built for bringing people in. They're built for bringing in money. So that's why they're here. All right, I'm going to hit my par for the week.
Sure.
This is probably, there's a big stories coming in the Olympics, and I'm not getting into the John Rahm situation of, like, he, you know, had COVID, he's got vaccinated, got double vaccinated, now he's got COVID again. How, like, what's going on? Like,
Like,
there's so much about that story that people don't understand, that, like, in North America, maybe I am getting into it. I'm just gonna get into it.
It sounds like you are.
In North America, we are so well off into the vaccination distribution that people do not understand the rest of the world, including Japan,
brutal,
is not in that same way. That if you somebody that is double vaccinated, it's probably aren't going to have any symptoms, yada, yada, yada. You are testing positive for COVID. Bring that over. Like, we could be in a much worse spot in that, you know, I know the golf is separated, that like maybe it spreads through. Like, there's a ton of Olympic athletes that are there that are going to be unvaccinated. And they just got to be so careful with those type of things. So obviously, John Rahm test positive. He's out. We got like Jose Maria Apollo, or all, I can't even say his last name.
Jorge Campillo.
Yeah, like just like they got like they're going to the bottom of the barrel. They got Seve playing,
which they didn't even have anybody at first. They actually
that's what I mean.
I got the IGF statement came out and it said not going to have a replacement player, and I was like, what? Yeah. And then got the replacement today, first thing this morning.
They had to go deep into their they had to go into, what was that tournament? We always joke about the Bermuda tournament where they had Jack Nicklaus's son playing in it still and like all that. Like, that's how deep Spain had to go to find somebody that was willing to go to these Olympics.
I think they had to go to another country to find a player. Yeah.
So obviously Bryson also tested positive and he's out and Patrick Reed is in. And that's my part for the week is that as much as I do not like Bryson and as much as I disdain Patrick Reed, I'm unsure of how this is a win for anybody. I understand Bryson's at this point where it's like everybody hates him. But the goal of the Olympics is, and what we've been talking about for years, and you know, Rory talked about years ago, like, I didn't start playing golf to grow the game, right? Is to grow the game. That's why they somehow got back. Who of those two is probably going to grow the game more? I keep saying game. Who's going to grow the game more? Is it Patrick Reed, who literally plays a very old school style, right? He hits it, what, 275 carry in the air, right? Like chips and putts, doesn't hit a lot of greens, not that flashy by any stretch of the imagination. Or Bryson, who's going to be different than everyone else in that tournament and just hit bombs, right? And it's like, I'm kind of happy I don't have to listen to Bryson, and I'm really happy he's not going to win an Olympic gold medal and talk about it forever and post it on TikTok and all that nonsense. But I also don't want to see Patrick Reed because I don't think he actually does anything positive for the game.
I'm right with where you are. It's just kind of a wash, really, more than anything. I mean, I think Bryson probably could catch a few more eyeballs. But again, we're talking about eyeballs on TV. We're not talking about spectators, right? So, Reed earned his spot. He'll get in there. Whether he gets the podium or not, who knows? And I don't think this is the last of the, I mean, we're a few days now before the men start. But I don't think it's the last, withdrawal that we'll see. And I think even as we head into, the next competition with the women after that, I think we're probably going to see a few more withdrawals as well. I think that situation is going to exist. People just better be prepared for it.
Yeah, it's crazy. We were hoping to have a caddy that is in that tournament next week. Not gonna get into it yet. Just hoping. You never know with these type of things. So I don't want to get you all excited, but you never know. So I think we're gonna break down that whole experience. I'm really, really looking forward to it.
Yeah, for sure.
Why don't you hit your par and then I'll wrap it up with my birdie for the week.
Yeah, par for me is, obviously I have to track a lot of amateur tournaments during the year. This year, because of COVID, a lot of the schedules are compressed around the world. That's usually in the United States and Canada as well. So it's been really wild. I mean, we're seeing players that are basically having to bail out of, you know, certain championships to play in other ones and make a lot of choices. While I'm grateful and all the players are grateful that, you know, a lot of these tournaments are returning, the schedules are so overlapping that they're having to make a lot of decisions. We're also seeing a lot of tournaments with weaker fields, smaller fields, things like that. I just think, you know, maybe things needed to taper a little bit into the activity. And if there was a small window, make it happen this way. For an example, in Canada, Canadian amateur got moved. Ontario amateur is later as well. Means some players going back to college couldn't play in it. All sorts of different things that way. But also in the States as well, a lot of the state championships are happening at the same time as big events like the Western Amateur and Porter Cup and things are happening. So players are having to make a lot more choices. So just for me, it's just too bad. Again, it's great that the tournaments are back and they're being played, but it's just unfortunate that the schedules aren't a little bit more clear and that players aren't as confused with where they should be playing and how many tournaments they can play in.
Yeah, it's packed. I've heard of even just golf in general, like I've heard of a golf course, a couple golf courses, you know, not honoring vacation requests of the staff because it's so busy. Or, yeah.
And they don't have staff.
I mean, yeah. Canada, I think we're in a better spot, but like, I know America, like people aren't working. Like there's a big issue where people are going to make more money not working than they are working, which I think in the end might actually be a good thing. And they might actually get their minimum wage to a respectable place.
Right.
But like, there's a lot of issues with all of that type of stuff, but at the same time, people got to live too, right? Like world can't revolve around golf. If I need a vacation, I'm taking my vacation, and my job at a golf course, probably like I can probably find something else around the same price, especially if it's a summer gig. So it's such a hard balance for owners of golf courses. It's tough, but we'll get back to, hopefully once we get this wrapped up, you know, most sports I think are hoping to get back to a regular schedule, like the NHL, NBA, all those.
Yeah,
we're get right back in that regular schedule come the fall.
Yeah, we're getting a lot closer and things will definitely normalize. So that's why I said I'm not trying to complain about it. I'm just, you know, presenting the fact that there are certain issues that are happening right now. You know, again, grateful that things are returning, but complications as a result of it end up being a par.
I like it. I'm going to wrap it up with a birdie, and it's Dylan Wu. He just picks up his first win on the Korn Ferry Tour. He will be heading to the PGA Tour next year. And I'm giving a birdie for, obviously, the win and the fact that he's heading there. And I wanted to be like, are we not talking about this guy enough? Like, is the media not talking about this guy enough? And so I dove into some research of why I think maybe that is, right? Taylor Pendrith.
And I know.
Taylor Pendrith is unbelievable. Maybe you have a different thought, so I'll let you get into it. But Pendrith, obviously, you know, he's been up there all year. He's unbelievable. Hits it forever, right? There's all these flashy names out there on the Korn Ferry Tour. And then you look at Dylan Wu, and he's just kind of like every stat right down the middle. Like his driving distance on the Korn Ferry Tour is 296. Most people, if I told you, hey, it's his average is 296, you'd probably think, oh, nice, probably like top 50, you know, driving average. This guy's ranked 112 at 296. Yeah. The top guy out on the Korn Ferry Tour is Brent Grant. He's averaging 323 with Taylor Pendrith just behind him, 1 yard back. So like, these guys are bombing it out there. But I just dove in really quickly off the tee. His best stat is driving accuracy. He's 30th on tour. You're not going to find much better than that. Approach the green, 44th. Around the green, his best stat is 28th. Like, everything's just kind of right around that 30 mark. He's just kind of, you know, he just plays his golf. His only close stat to top 10 is birdies. So, like, I just think he's one of those guys that it's like, does this make for a career where I'm expecting this guy to come in on the PGA Tour and have just an amazing career? No, but dude, this looked like a journeyman potentially in the making, where you look at the end of the year, like, holy crap, Dylan Wu made $5 million again this year. Like, that's kind of what I'm seeing here. Maybe that's why we're not talking about him enough. But what are your thoughts of why we're not talking about
him? Why we're not talking about him is going back to, you're talking about his stats on the golf course, but if we look at his stats as far as finishes, he hasn't had a top 10 finish in a year. So if you look back at his record, and I dug into that as well, I mean, it's been a year since he had a T11 in there. But because he's steady and consistent, which, you know, goes to your journeyman theory, that's why people are talking about him. I mean, if you get a player that's all of a sudden finishing onesies, twosies, or losing in a playoff or stuff like that, the name gets to be known. But if you're that player that's kind of just under the radar a little bit, where they're finishing, you know, 11th to 20th during a lot of weeks, they're making money, they're cashing checks, they're doing what they're supposed to be doing as a professional golfer. They're earning their way to the top and getting themselves a spot. It just so happens that all of a sudden you shoot 25 under, get a win, that gives that extra boost that's going to get him to the PGA Tour. But that, you know, that's supported by what he has done, even though he hasn't had a top 10 in the last year.
Yeah, he's one I think that really, really, really benefited from this big, massive wraparound season. He probably, if we look at probably late September last year, if that's when they would have wrapped it up and did Korn Ferry Tour finals and all of that, he's not in. He would have had a T2, a T4, a T5, a bunch of missed cuts. And it's obviously like one of his first, it's his first full year out on the tour. He had limited status in 2019 on the Korn Ferry Tour, had a second at that point, but, you know, missed 9 of 13 cuts. So, like, I wouldn't call that a great year. Probably had to go back to Korn Ferry Tour finals just to get his status. Yep. So, yeah, one of those stories where it's like the benefit the good way. And there's obviously, we've talked about the guys on the PGA Tour that, you know, at that kind of 200 mark that have benefited from this massive wraparound season, right, that would be out here on the Korn Ferry Tour too. But we're not diving into that, those top 25 in the Korn Ferry Tour enough that, like, hey, this guy's, he's got to thank COVID a little bit, because without it, he's not heading to the PGA Tour next year. I don't know if that's the case with Dylan, but it looked like it from a distance.
Yeah, for sure.
All right. Well, that's the week.
Oh, I still got a honorable mention in there.
Oh, you got an honorable mention. I do. What? I think it's a good one, though.
Yeah, actually, you know what? This week, Mackenzie Investments Open is being played at Le Blainvilliers, north of Montreal. It is the first official Mackenzie Tour event after 683 days. And you know as well as I, we've had a lot of players on here. It's very important for those development tours to get back playing, get these players some reps, get them in the system as far as PGA Tour. It's just great to see. They've got 8 events this year, but this is the kickoff and the start to it. And looking forward. Great field. I had a dig through it, the 144 players. Obviously, very heavy as far as Canadians are concerned. Few players couldn't get into the field. They couldn't kind of make it back. Brad Fritsch intended to play in it, but he won't be. There was a couple other players that were intending to get back as well and couldn't make it, just with some restrictions and different things that are going on. But yeah, it's great to see the tour back. And I've talked to a number of players. Or David Byrne, who's obviously been on the show, he's down in Montreal this week. And yeah, it's great to see the circuit going. And hopefully next month I'm going to get to one of the events in PEI as well.
Yeah, funny. I'm on the website, and my boy Josh Whalen is the face of this tournament.
Oh, is he? Yeah,
they're going inside the field, and he's standing there, and Josh would love it. But like,
that's funny.
Josh barely got status this year in the Mackenzie Tour. So if Josh is the face of it, we might be in trouble. Shout out to Josh. I think he's looking forward to it. David Byrne, obviously, heading out there. He was passed by Kingston at a weird time. We were hoping to grab a beer with him, but couldn't make it happen. Yeah. What other names did you see in the field that that stuck out to you?
Well, just some players that have been, you know, top Canadian players that are sort of getting their start as pros, you know, guys like Sam Meek and Johan Benson, who was on this show. Johan's in the field there. Wow. They're obviously getting a lot of homegrown talent as far as guys from Quebec.
Do you have to dust his clubs off?
Well, maybe, but I mean, he can certainly play, that's for sure. So yeah. a lot of good players out of Quebec. I thought Joey Savoy was supposed to be in the field, but he's not. You know, we've got other Canadians in there. You know, Jake McNulty's in there, Sam Meek, Tony Gill, who was a hot and up-and-coming player a few years ago with Team Canada. There's quite a selection of players that have maybe been, you know, sort of on the bench a little bit, and now they're going to, you know, get back out there and get themselves an opportunity, which is, again, nice to see. They're players that have maybe finished college in the last couple of years and then sort of disappeared a bit, and now they've got this chance to get back out there on an official circuit.
Yeah, look out for a guy like Brendan Leonard, who's been playing very good golf, Toronto Players Tour. Yeah, he's Brendan kind of Leonard, always in the mix, picked up a bunch of wins last year. So, I'd look out for that name early on the Mackenzie Tour.
Anthony Brodeur is in the field, too, who used to play in our Flagstick Open and might be well-known for, you know, he's a goalie as well, and his dad was kind of a decent goalie for.
He's all right.
Yeah,
a couple teams. I think St. Louis Blue, former St. Louis Blue.
Yeah, that's it. That's what he's known for.
Yeah, that's what he's known for.
But yeah, but Anthony here turned pro last year. He's in that field as well. So again, it's good. A little bit different this year because obviously they have the Formel Tour down in the States. It's a little bit of the equivalent. So some of the Canadians that are based in the U.S. are playing that tour. So you won't see them up here in Montreal, but a lot of the Canadian-based players are in the field for this one. And there's an opportunity for some younger guys to get in there and get those exemptions and get a chance to play.
All right. What do we want to do for the Olympics? Do we want to just give our three players that we believe are going to medal? Do you want to do a draft? What do you want to do here, Scott?
No, we'll just mention some names of players that we think are good bets basically for to medal and get in the mix. How's that?
Yeah, I like it. So to start, I'm gonna pick a Canadian. I think I like both of our Canadians a lot this week at the Olympics. I think they're just playing great golf. And I got to go with Mac Hughes. Mac, I think, is in a stretch that is underrated. I know Corey you know, his ball striking travels around the world, but putting sure. travels around the world too. And if Max Putter gets hot and the Olympics, watch out. I think I could see, you know, I could see Mac picking up a bronze medal or something along those lines. I really like both of them, but if I got to pick one, I got to go Mac. Who's your first guy you're looking at?
Yeah, I wouldn't be shocked by that. We have to understand too, with 60 players on each side, we certainly don't have the depth of players that we would in, say, a PGA Tour event. So I'd say the odds are better for some of the top ranked players. And, you know, you can see that when you go down the odds, probably the top 30 players.
Out you don't
of
the like 60. Hurley Long?
Yeah, exactly. That's what I mean. You look at those top 30 players, you're like, oh, okay. That person I know, they have a chance. And then you're looking down going, Hurley Long? Who?
Yeah. Uvik Magnusson?
Yeah, exactly.
Gavin Green? Yeah, all right.
You know, very, very far down. So I would certainly say that gives a better opportunity for the big names. So we're all going to look a little bit smarter. I think this week, anybody that's making predictions in over the next 2 weeks, because it's going to be easier to pick out the players. You know what? I can't stray away from Morikawa. Obviously, you know, he's the favorite going in there. A bit of a heater coming off the Open. And, you know, as you say, guys, games that travel, his game travels anywhere as he goes. So I know it's a bad pick in the fact that it's an easy pick, but certainly I could see him on the podium for sure.
For sure. I know I didn't say he's going to grow the game by any means over there, but this guy turns into something else when he plays for America. And I'm not calling him it, but I think Patrick Reed's going to be on, you know, on that podium.
Like a Marvel character.
Yeah, I it would be the worst seeing his face standing up there in an interview after just talking about...
Well, he's going to be comfortable with the uniform because he's used to wearing red, white, and blue and the stars and stripes all the time, right?
Yep, so I'll go Patrick Reed. I don't love it, but I just have a bad feeling it's going to happen. And then I got... you go next, and I got a couple. All right. I'm kind of between two here.
All right, you mentioned the Aussies being on a bit of a heater. And, you know, here's the thing. I didn't really spend a lot of time strategizing as I dug through the names. It was just names that jumped out at me. And especially for players that have been playing well, but maybe haven't, you know, got a number of wins or got a win. But Cam Smith, I think the Olympics means a lot to Australia. And I'm sure it means to a lot to a lot of other countries around the world as well. But I think he's just kind of the guy who will go have fun, embrace representing the country. And, you know, certainly has the skills to make something happen there. Yeah. So Cam Smith is my number two pick.
Got an awesome. Not tattooed, but hair tattooed in the side of his head.
Exactly.
Pretty cool. Yeah, he's definitely living it up, that's for sure. So my third pick, I almost want to guarantee it, and I just hope it happens, is Sungjae Im. This is one where I think the world should be cheering for both of them, him and Siwoo Kim, who, you know, neither are on the prime right now of the last year. They're struggling. I think this is weighing on both of them a lot. Yeah. And I'm cheering for Sungjae Im a lot. I feel like I'm picking this one with my heart. and in my extra one where I would sub out all three of them, I'm just going to have an extra as a fourth, is Tommy Fleetwood. I feel like this is a guy everyone's looking for that breakthrough, that big win. That when's he going to get it? And it's going to be the Olympics. And people
are like, gold medal.
It's 60 man field, blah, 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 blah. I could see Tommy sneak in there.
Speaking of sneaky guys, again, another great player, a guy who has a Canadian caddying for him. I think because his country maybe hasn't had the greatest record of, you know, in the Olympics as far as medals are concerned, I think it'll be very important for him. It was another player from his country who carried the flag in Gabby Lopez, but Abraham Answer. You know, again, a game that travels very well. Dale Vallely is a caddy. I'm sure they're having a good time. But I think Abraham, you know, obviously has, you know, potential every week to win wherever he is. And it's still shocking that he has not won more based on his skill level.
Yeah, that short game is...
it's crazy.
Yeah, it's something... something different, that's for sure. All right, let's hit the women. Why don't you go first? Who's somebody you're almost guaranteeing a medal for?
Yeah, you know what? We know just because of our affiliation with her caddy and how much this tournament means to her. In fact, you know, she pulled out of the Avion just because she wanted to reduce travel complications that she possibly was going to have. It was huge for her as a goal to make this team. And I think Mel Reed for Great Britain, I think she's the type of player that if you look at her, she sort of has the makeup of a lot of Olympic athletes in other sports. She's fiercely determined. She's, you know, she just has that extra gear, which maybe doesn't lend itself always to golf, but it lends itself to a lot of other sports. And I think because of that and that importance to her to, you know, represent her country and be in the Olympics, I think Mel Reed's a great pick to medal.
Yeah, I like that. I know she's been chatting a lot with Brooks Koepka about, you know, getting her mindset for these bigger tournaments and how to mentally prepare for them, not just physically prepare, which, you know, Brooks doesn't talk about that type of stuff outside. And it's like, he prepares more than I think people give him credit for. I mean, you can't start without the 7-1 favorite, Nelly Korda, in my
opinion.
like just on a heater, like no other. What do I need to say?
And she was on my list too. Yeah. I mean, there's nothing you can say. You can't really get past her. I mean, if you didn't pick her, I'd have to call you stupid. Really. I mean, just the way she has played this year and Olympic tradition, athlete tradition in her family. And I think it becomes that greater level of importance for her. And just based on what she's been doing of late, I mean, she just does not look like she's going to ever finish out of the top five in the tournament.
Exactly. So with such a small field, and the field is much stronger on the women's side than
I agree. Yeah,
in
for
my
sure.
opinion. Yeah. But who's your second pick?
I'm going to go Danielle Kang. Nice. You know, I think
kind of right in with Korda this year.
Yeah, exactly. Same type of thing. Great player, a grinder, gives it that little extra effort. You know, major champion, always seems to be playing steady. Doesn't seem to have a lot of downside. I think she's a strong pick always.
Yeah, I like that. I was looking at that. But I got to go. I got to have Canadian content in here, and I actually do believe Brooke picks up a win. Picks up a medal. Okay. I could see her winning. I know her game isn't, you know, she's not on a heater by any means, but
yeah,
I think this means a lot to Brooke. No, like, she's a proud Canadian. Like, she talks about her roots a lot. They talk about, like, every single shot is about Canadian Brooke Henderson. They don't do that about everyone else, but it's like, like, she almost made it into a contract with CBS and NBC. She has to mention it. I like it. I know it's a homer pick, but I'm taking the homer pick. And let's go with Brooke.
Well, it's just too bad for her that her good friend Bailey Anderson, who's actually in the 200 IM from Smith Falls as well, made the team for Canada. So the two of them are Olympians, but they're not going to be able to cross paths and stuff over there. So I think it's still a cool story that way as well.
Yeah, it's such a bummer that they're not getting that experience of the Olympic Village. But hey, Brooke's young. What is she, 23? Like, she's gonna get 10 of these.
Yeah, if she wants it, it's certainly going to be available to her. Well, you know what? A third pick here, because obviously I agreed with you on Nelly and I had her on my sheet, but I'm going to take Nasa Hatayoka. Part of the reason for that is obviously she's a strong player doing some things well. Home country, you know, I think there's a lot to be said in competition as far as will to perform and will to win, and it adds an extra gear for an athlete. It's always important. I mean, any player will tell you that in any sport that, you know, when you have an opportunity to play at home, you always seem to be focused a little bit more and try to put a little bit more effort into it. And while that doesn't always lend its way into golf, I think it'll be important for her. And I think it'd be great for Japan if that happened.
I love it. I'm going to go with my heart here. This is a big heart pick. I talked about it a few weeks ago that I think it's a shame if we don't get to see her more. And this might be the last tournament we ever see her in on a big screen. And it's Shan Shan Fang, Yeah, I need to see it. I know she won't be wearing the cow pants out there, but you know, out there representing China, I think.
Yeah, that would be a popular win. That really would be, or a medal in any way. So
yeah, like just even like, you know, a bronze medal just to wrap it up. I'm sure she'd make jokes about it and just be awesome. And yeah, I'm looking forward to it. It's weird timing. Like it starts at 6:30 p.m. this Wednesday. It's going to be just weird timing watching the golf and, you know, watch until what, 3 a.m. I don't know how much I'll really be able to see.
Yeah, the good part is at least with it separated, so we can focus on the men first and then we can focus on the women. It's not going on at the same time, so they can all get their due attention out of it as well. So that'll be great.
I like it.
But it's been hard watching some of the Olympics. I tried to watch some late last night and it was a bit of a struggle. I mean, there's obviously so much going on for the sports. They're jumping all over the place. So I'm hoping the golf broadcast is a little bit more prolonged so we actually get to see a few more shots.
I love it. Well, Scott, why don't you hit the interview for us? You did this interview yourself. Why don't you give us, you gave us a quick breakdown, but why don't you introduce the man himself?
Yeah, Stuart Anderson, a native of Fort McMurray, Alberta, who you know, played for a long time on the Canadian Tour, made his way up to the Corn Ferry Tour. And you know what? He's one of those guys where maybe the money ran out before the talent did. Very popular guy on tour. Almost everybody, you know, universally loves Stu. Disco Stu is his nickname. A fun guy. But you know what? He's got a lot of things going on in his life, and he's kind of moved on a little bit. But now he's sort of diving back into golf, and he didn't play for 3 years, as you'll hear in the interview. But he's coming back to the game for specific reasons, and he's got multiple paths set up for himself in order for him to stay in the game. And I think people will enjoy hearing a little bit about his story, but also his perspective of being a two-time World Cup competitor and also being a four-time winner on the Canadian Tour. All right, we want to welcome to the show a longtime friend, somebody I've known for quite some time, and a very prominent player as far as the Canadian Tour is concerned. A lot of people these days maybe don't know his name, but certainly anybody who's been in the Canadian golf industry in the last 20 years does. Stuart Anderson, four-time winner on the Canadian Tour, including two tour championships. He's also getting back into the game a little bit, which sort of prompted us to have this conversation. We've been trying to get together for a little while, but welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks, Scott. Nice to be here. You know, nice to chat with you. Same birthday as me.
Yeah, the birthday brothers is always something we've always connected about. But certainly, you know, watching you play back in the day, you know, a talented player. You don't have to go on about yourself because I will go on about you for sure. But let's talk a little bit. You're an Alberta boy, you know, grew up Fort McMurray. And why don't you tell us a little bit how you got into the game before we really get into when you started to have a lot of success?
Well, it was my dad for sure. He got us. My sister was a golf professional for a long time as well. So he was the driving force in that. It was something for us to really do in the summer. And it was more of a daycare for my parents. They'd just drop us off and my sister and I would be there all day playing golf. And we competed against each other because at that time, you know, late 80s, early 90s, golf wasn't that cool. Tiger wasn't on scene yet. And it was something we competed in, you know, obviously my dad and my mom really supported both of us, drove us to tournaments all over Alberta and whatnot. So they made it fun for us as well.
Fun, as you said, and something competitive within your family. When did you start to get the bug of, you know, the competitive game and thinking, you know what, I can do something with this?
Well, but I think you're answering, you know, or asking where my competitiveness got. It was in the 11, 12 year old range, playing some Edmonton City junior tournaments and traveling Alberta. But I was fortunate enough when I was 14, my dad took a job with a couple of Canadian guys and we moved here from Fort McMurray, Alberta to Mesa, Arizona. So I went 2.5 years of high school in Arizona. Played golf on the golf teams there and really improved. My dad joined a country club down there, Alta Mesa Country Club, and I played with his friends, and they were all competitive golfers. You know, they're called the gross guys, so their handicaps were they played gross. There was an Epp Brothers group as well, so I got some competitive golf playing with them. And obviously, my teammates in high school were really good. One of them, Ryan Hogue, he's you've mentioned him on the show as well.
We have, yeah.
He's caddy for Marty Jurtson. And Hoagie's was a real close friend of mine, and we won the state championship in 96 at Lucinda's Golf Course in Arizona there. So that was a highlight in high school, and didn't really know what I wanted to do with the game and school-wise. So I started out at Mesa Community College, went a year there, and decided that there were some Canadians down in Casa Grande Coolidge area. So I transferred over to Central Arizona College and played a year there, and then got a full ride to Illinois State and graduated December 2000. Illinois State turned pro in February of 2001. So it was kind of just a streamline.
So when you did that in 2001, did you think that was a bit of a gamble, or did you think your game at that point was ready to play the professional game, or did you even know?
I didn't really know, but I had some investors that were willing to back me. So I jumped in the pool. I probably wasn't ready to dive in from the high dive board, but it was a school of hard knocks. My first year, I only made one cut, I think it was in Edmonton. And it was definitely a learning process, being on your own, traveling, you know, paying everything out of your own pocket. College, you know, the school's paying for everything, paying for the flights, whatnot. So definitely learned a lot that first year. And the next year was a little better. I had an incident in Vancouver. I rolled my ankle on Sunday driving. Well, I went breakfast and rolled my ankle with a caddy in the morning. We were playing Swanee Set, and I was staying in New West, so it's like an hour drive. And by the time I got to the golf course, my ankle was the size of a tennis ball. And it was the first time I was in the hunt. I was in the second last group. So this is my first, you know, in the hunt, could possibly win the event, whatnot. So rolled my ankle, ended up shooting like 3 over the front 9, had a tensor bandage on. The doctor said I shouldn't even play before I started. But I did, and shot 3 under on one leg on the back 9. And going up 18, I teared up. It was probably one of the most heartfelt moments in my career where I, you know, I did this. I battled through like a tough situation and looked at the leaderboard. Now my name was in the top 10. So I was like, the tears started just flooding out. And then the next week we played in Victoria, and I birdied the last 5 holes to miss the cut by 1 because I didn't play Monday, Tuesday, or Wednesday because of my ankle. So, and then the next week was Edmonton, where I shot 21 under and lost in a playoff to Matt Daniel in the first hole. So I look back in early in my career going, you know, if I didn't play that round in Vancouver on that busted ankle, who knows where I might have been. It might have been another year of missed cuts, and, you know, another year down the road, I'm done. But yeah, I grinded through it. So that was a proud moment that I look back.
I mean, people are probably not as familiar, but, you know, can you sort of describe the environment back then? I mean, that's 20 years ago now. You know, this was pre McKenzie Tour days, as far as the PGA Tour taking over, when that happened, you know, over a decade after that. But really describe what it was like then, as far as the competitiveness, you know, the travel, all sorts of things, everything that, you know, really described the tour back then.
Yeah, well, we were fortunate. My first year out, that was when we were down in the States. We're the only thing on the Golf Channel, really. We had the televised events down in Myrtle Beach. There was, you know, 4 events at the Barefoot Resort, yeah.
Yeah.
And that was my real first taste. And playing it later in the career, you know, obviously the Canadian Tour versus the McKenzie Tour, it just seems like these kids, they're so educated, and there's no secrets about golf anymore. And going back to the whole Golf Channel thing, we're the only live event, and it was infomercials and whatnot. Golf's not a secret anymore. There's so much information out there. There's so much science to it. These kids are so prepared with nutritionists and fitness coaches and swing coaches. It's back then, we were just digging it out of the dirt. You know, there's no TrackMan back then. But yeah, it was more of a casual, I guess, in comparison, it was professional golf, but it wasn't as, I guess, serious as it is now.
You know, yeah.
We had fun.
And you had lots of fun, obviously. You know, it's been well documented. I mean, we can talk about it a little bit here, but, you know, Disco Stew was your nickname and still continues to be. I mean, a lot of people recognize you for that, being the fun guy. You can share all you want, if you'd like, as far as, you know, personally of how that came about and, you know, transformations in your life. And I know, you know, there was a big transformation in your life. And I know you shared that in a Score article years ago.
Well, there wasn't a dance floor I was afraid of, empty or full. I had a good time. The article you're talking about is when I did make the decision to stop drinking. It was early in my career, just decided that if I wanted to do it full time, I needed to stop. I was a binge drinker. One was too many and 30 was never enough. So when you did struggle on Thursday, Friday, you had the weekend off. There was no work. So what did you do? You enjoyed the place you were at, whether it go with the guys for beers and cocktails or trying to meet a new interest in your life. So I just decided on a Saturday, you wake up hungover, you don't really want to practice, you know, hair the dog Saturday night. Sunday's a write-off as well. And then Monday's a travel day, laundry day. You only have 2 days prepared, Tuesday and Wednesday, and you're teaming up the next week. So it was just something that I knew that if I want to continue my career, I needed to stop. And a year later, after I quit drinking, I won my first event in California there and represented Canada for the first time at the World Cup in 2004. So it started a little more success in my career.
And you didn't have any fun at that World Cup. Darren Griff obviously was your partner.
Disco's still around. You can have a good time.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you and Griff.
Oh, yeah, my favorite person.
I can't even imagine you and Griff in Spain.
We can get into a story there if I want to. Oh, it was, I think we both got fined on it. But the reason the whole World Cup came about is Darren's friend, Tom, who was sitting on the board of the anchor at the time, found out that we didn't have a team going to the World Cup because Mike Weir decided he didn't want to play. So roundabout way through the International Federation PGA Tours, they found out that we could send a team to qualify. But that year in particular, it was right at final stage of Q School, so a lot of guys didn't want to go. I wasn't the first one Darren called to go. I know that for a fact, but I was the one that wanted to go. It was a international event, you know, representing your country. There's only two of you in golf. That's kind of special.
Yeah, for sure.
So I wasn't going to turn down the opportunity to go to Spain and represent Canada. At first, we had to go to Mexico to qualify, and that was a interesting of a week there. We ended up, we bogeyed our last hole and missed out on the top three positions. But fortunately, Carlos Franco decided to pull out, and we got in through the back door that way. And the rest is history. You know, we went over to Spain, and it was felt like it was Darren's deal because Tom found out about this. You know, Darren was his close buddy. I went over there. It was like, I was young, you know, it was early in my career. I was only out there for 3 years, and, you know, Darren was out there for more and had some success in the KA Tour. So he was more of a statesman and kind of pushed his weight around. Like I was only there because of him.
Nice.
So, later that next year in California, we had a little run-in together on the tee box where a lot of obscenities were thrown out and whatnot, but it was interesting times.
So moving on to, you know, we'll go back to the World Cup because obviously you ended up representing Canada again in 2009, but you mentioned California there and getting that first win, you know, kind of weird, obviously it's a Canadian tour event, but you know, you're winning it in California, but you know, kind of what did that mean to you as far as a vindication maybe or affirmation that as a professional, you could be successful?
Well, definitely. It was, I was elated. You know, the field was strong. There was a lot of good California players there. You know, I think Mike Robb was a guy that came down to the end I was battling with. And I hit some shots coming down the stretch that were just like, I got this, you know. Mentally you're like, no one's beating me. So it was invalidation. I've always been a good ball striker and lacked a little bit in the short game, but I won that tournament with ball striking. And I was there, you know, the guys were there to chase me around with beer. I know Barilla and a few of the Canadians were there with cocktails, but I avoided the beer shower. I didn't think this big guy could move so fast.
Probably move the fastest in your life.
Yeah, pretty much. You know, well, because it was early. It was one of those things where I think if I had one, I probably would have continued. But
yeah,
you know, it was a good decision. And that's the thing about the Canadian Tour. It took us all over early in my career. You mentioned California, but we're in Mexico. Like, there's probably 15 different places in Mexico I played in, all over the state. So it definitely well-traveled a lot of us. Not too great on the pocketbook because the first couple of years, the Canadian dollar was in that 60 range. So it was tough.
I guess it was more of a motivation to play that much better every year. And, you know, it carried through. Obviously, you know, you became a winner again the next year. I believe that was your first tour championship in 06. Was that it?
Yeah, in 06 in Barrie. That was a tough week. Well, our close, well, Brad Fritch, obviously, he was right up there. And Matt McQuillan, you know, a real close friend of ours as well. Matt, he's, you know, had a good career, played some good golf. But it was a tough course, that Horseshoe Resort up in Barrie. Like, it was tight. I know, I think I shot 7 under and I won by 3, and there was only like 3 guys under par.
Wow.
Like, it was, but I won that turn because I just said, I'm hitting driver everywhere. I'm going to be aggressive. And guys were hitting, you know, 5s and 7 irons off the tee. And I'm just busting driver and chipping it around. So that was a good week.
You know, we'll carry through and, you know, we'll get through all your Canadian tour stuff and chat about it a bit. You know, when this podcast is coming out, the Mackenzie Tour is resuming in Montreal, in the Montreal area. You did win the Montreal Open back in 09. And I remember watching you out there as well that year. You know, at that point in your career, you know, in 09 was obviously ended up being a big year for you as well with the World Cup, you and Dillette going to China. But, you know, maybe describe that year for you and why that year was important.
Well, it was important because it was, you know, my last win before that was the Tour Championship in 06. And it was, I just kind of lost my way a little bit. But it was a good year. I want to say I was in contention probably 3 or 4 times. I know Calgary, I was there. Dillette got me by a couple. Every week I felt like I could win. It was a very consistent year. And then in Montreal, I just put the pedal down. I was a few shots behind Hugo, but made those up early in the round. And then again, just won the tournament ball striking. When my irons are on, I feel like I can hit it just as good as anybody in the world. And maybe I should look into the Top Golf because of that, because the other aspects of the game are always struggling a bit. But no, 2009 was very important. You know, Graham and I went to China. We struggled on the alternate shot days, but we played really good all days. I had my closest friend there, Danny Saul, you know. He was there caddying for me. He had a good career as a golfer as well. Now he's, you know, had some prominent bags on tour. Most recently, Corey Connors are, yep. You know, they're in Tokyo right now. So hopefully they can do well in the Olympics.
You know, how many of those guys do you keep in touch with? I mean, obviously you form a lot of bonds over the years. We know about ours just being linked, and obviously we weren't as close, you know, then as you would be with those players. But how many of those guys do you keep in touch with?
You know, there's probably only a handful that I keep in touch on a regular basis. But I know myself and the relationships I did for them. I think if I had to call somebody up, they'd be more than willing to answer the phone. Good friend of mine, when I did play the Corn Ferry out in 2012, Tag Ridings, he just won, you know, 46-year-old one. That was pretty emotional for me because we had lots of practice rounds together. Every week we had a, it was myself, Jason Gore, Tag Ridings, and Josh Broadway. We had a Biggins versus Littlins match every Tuesday. Jason and I were partners against Tag and Josh. Not that they're small guys, but Jason and I were bigger. And those kind of bonds, you look back, like we wanted to, we were looking to create a Tuesday golf game where we could benefit, have a skins game between the Jason and I versus Tag and Josh and benefit a charity in the area. So it didn't fly off the handle like we wanted, but we formed some good bonds. I can remember singing Notorious B.I.G. song, Juicy Down the Fairway with all four of those guys, and we're just rapping it with the tunes on. So just so many little things that I look back on my career that were so fun. Right?
Yeah.
And the bonds, those guys are important. And it's nice to see Tag doing well. And Danny and Jason with the USGA now. Yeah.
Perfect guy for player relations, really.
Oh, he's bar none, probably the nicest guy you'll ever met. And most talented guy. Like the guy on a guitar, I don't know if you ever seen him play. Jason is an amazing guy. And he'd be good for your show as well.
Yeah, I thought it was funny this past winter. He dropped into an online forum because he was building out a simulator in his house, and everybody was sort of surprised that really, is this Jason Gore on a forum just asking questions? And you know, he's just an everyman more than anything, which is I think why he's so relatable and you know does such a good job now with the USGA for sure. I mean, you know, you mentioned that as far as good times, you know, and you can tell us what you want or don't want or whatever from the stories. But, you know, were there incidents or things that happened over the years that you still, you know, look back and laugh at of all those years of traveling? Because, you know, obviously when you're traveling, things happen, you know, and you've got a bunch of guys trying to make a living and doing some things. But, you know, were there funny things that still stand out in your mind?
Well, I know. Well, he was a guest on your show too, Will Wilcox. You know, he's a great personality. But that year he came up, he talked about he won his first event in Saskatoon. Well, the next week was Winnipeg, and I was paired up with him, and we had a lady walking score with us, and you remember it was par three on the back, so 14. He's not having a great day. But he comes off that green and yells every obscenity known to man right in front of our walking score. And he was doing that most of the day, and I just kind of had enough. And I just went over to him and said, you know, Will, I know you won last week, whatnot, but you need to grow up. This lady didn't volunteer out here to hear you say some of the things that you just did. So you need to grow up. And he kind of looked at me and kind of just, you know, gave me a okay. And from then on, we had a good relationship. You know, you can't act like that. There's so many people that volunteer. And that's one thing I prided myself on. All the volunteers, if I ever hit one off to the side or you have those spotters on the tee box, I made sure that I introduced myself and got their names. And I can still remember Gil and Dave on the tee box in Winnipeg. Number 7 and 13, it's a double tee box. Those guys were there for every year I was there, and they made it fun. They're like, oh, how's Mr. Anderson today? Like, just little things like that. But Will, you know, he's struggling right now. I know I've listened to the podcast and seen his Twitter account, and he's kind of at a crossroads, but I know he's got the game to do it. You know, what he shoot, 59, he's won wherever he's played. It's golf. You just go through those tough times.
I mean, you mentioned that, you know, of being grateful. Why do you think you are so grateful for a lot of things? Do you think that just comes from your parents' upbringing? You know, you always seem to be, even when you didn't play well, you always seem to be ready to answer questions to the media. As you said, talk to the volunteers, be appreciative. What is it in you, do you think, that, you know, why is it?
Just a kid from Fort McMurray, Alberta, you know, that got to travel the world and play golf in Estonia on the Baltic Sea. It was special to me, and I'll cherish those moments the rest of my life. And the reason a little bit of getting into golf this year is because of my kids. Funny, Lucas Glover just won recently, and he mentioned how it was, he wanted his kids to see him play. And that was kind of my motivation for this year, is my kids are old enough to understand why I was away, what, you know, traveling the world, what I was doing. So I just want to have another kick at the cat. And if it's only this year, I kind of have a 3-4 year plan in my head that just baby steps, because I do want to keep my employment and a steady paycheck. So, but I'd love to have status again somewhere in the next 4 years, just baby step wise, and love the game again and love those experiences that I got to experience.
So yeah, you know, you went away from the game for a little bit. How hard was that for you to, you know, you obviously had other priorities in life, but you know, how hard was it to kind of turn your back on golf for a little bit?
It was easy. I put the clubs away for 3 years and never looked at them.
Wow.
You know, it just, it was one of those things where I can't do it. And then the fourth year, it was like, we're getting pretty rusty. Maybe we should dust them off a little bit. And then last year I ended up playing the Alberta Open with Alberta Golf here and really struggling. I only gave myself a couple weeks of practice because I was working full time and whatnot, but just started to get the juices again. And then I lost one of my number one fans, my grandmother, this year. And like, you know what, I got some stuff in the tank and my kids want to see me golf, and I don't have to improve overnight. I just need baby steps. So I've been working on my fitness. I'm probably in the best shape that I've been in my life. Like, I'm really thin, need to get a little stronger. So in talking with a few of the Champions Tour guys, you know, guys that are chasing out there and whatnot, you just got to work towards something and set goals and small goals. And this year it's going to be fitness and just swinging the club again. I know the mental side of it is something that I'm really going to have to improve on. I've lost the golfer's mind for sure.
Yeah. And I mean, you're 43 now. Is that where you're?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, there's obviously lots of time if you're, you know, targeting something like the, you know, the Champions Tour or whatever. But as you said, you know, the ball striking and that part is sort of integral to you, but you know, the competitiveness and getting your brain in the game is a little bit more difficult, maybe at this point, but maybe it's just sort of remembering what you did in the past, or, you know, so how do you go about doing that? What's your process as far as this sort of plan that you're taking on?
Well, the mental side of it, definitely. I've looked into therapy, maybe even possibly hypnotism.
It's that extreme, is it?
Yeah, maybe erase some of those experiences. We always talk about yips, and it's not a real thing, but it is. It is, and I'm struggling right now with the driver and the tee ball.
Which was always a strength for you as well. I mean, I know your irons are strong, but, you know, watching you hit a golf ball off a tee was always a highlight, whether there was a piece of cheesecake under it or not. We could tell that story in a minute. But you know, the driver was your strength. Just like you said, that tour championship, you know, at Hockley Valley or whatever, or Horseshoe, sorry. And you know, taking on the driver and just, you know, just wailing away and not really thinking about it. But now you probably, you know, you're thinking about it, right?
Yeah. Well, it's as you get older, the good and the bad experiences, and it's just right now I'm struggling to move those negative thoughts out. So I'm going to work hard on practicing. I practiced a lot this year, but I didn't practice a lot of the right things. You know, I played a little bit of golf in some tournaments of late, and my score is quite been atrocious, but I look back on it and it's the mental side of it that has got me there. The negative thinking, the skipping the process of stepping to the tee. Where's the pin? Mm-hmm. Where's my best angle of attack? Like, just the whole course management side of it that I felt like I've lost in those years that I just took off and just need to go practice that. instead of working on my golf swing or hitting shots. It's more of playing the game.
What do you think the motivation is for you? Like you said about, you know, seeing your kids, seeing you play, you think you still have a little bit left in the tank. You know, do you still have that deep love of golf? Is that part of the fire that's burning for you?
Absolutely. I can, even in Fort McMurray, like we talked about, I can remember being competitive, and it was my life for so many years. You know, like I woke up to live for golf, and seeing so many guys that I competed against having so much success, maybe in that regards, I'm like, shit, this guy's making how many millions of dollars? And, you know, I competed with them, felt like I was a better player at times than them. But more than that, just the love of the game, being out there, being able to spread my knowledge. I know I'm living in Stettler, Alberta right now, and with the town course here, there isn't too many kids that come out, but when I do see kids, I try to spread some knowledge and do my best with that. I think I have a lot to give. I'd like to give it to myself on the golf course and be successful, but if that doesn't work out, being around the game and being to help people improve. Like I find myself, even when I play with buddies and men's night stuff, I'm coaching through the shots. Like, why did you hit it there where, you know, you have all this room left, you know, with just the course management, it's helping me.
I was going to say, maybe you're going to get back your mental side of it and your management side of it through the coaching end of it more than anything.
Yeah, no. And I do see that a little bit because I love calling my shot. That's what gets me off in the game is standing behind it, visualizing and executing. There's no better feeling in golf than that. And trying to teach that to individuals, it's not the particular tree you're hitting at. It's the certain branch. It's a certain leaf on that tree, and narrowing the focus where your dispersion kind of narrows in when you focus better. And focus on teaching people and coaching people is something I've always thought I'd be good at. I don't know if I have the patience to stand on a range and do swing lessons, but I think my more specialty in coaching and helping people would be on the golf course, which in return, like you said, would help me get that golfer's brain back as well.
For sure. Maybe you need a little chat in the mirror every now and then and pretend you're coaching yourself.
There we go. There's been a few of those, definitely, when you're on the road.
Yeah, I imagine. What do you think, you know, we've talked a little bit about some of the players these days, and obviously, you know, the access to technology and the advantages that maybe they have nowadays. But overall, you know, you've paid pretty close attention to the Canadian golf scene. Where do you think it sits now compared to 20 years ago when you turned pro?
Well, I think there's more availability to the media. I think there is a little more funding. I've always used the Olympic athlete. You know, now that the Olympics are on this week, we might as well use this analogy. We as Canadians, we want gold medals, but do we ever pay for those gold medals? I know so many winter athletes throughout Prince Albert the one year, and these athletes are working two jobs and training for the Olympics at the same time. And so I saw that early in my career in golf, and maybe it's changing, but it's our government to some degree, the tax benefits of allowing companies and individuals to sponsor. So I've seen a little bit of improvement in that. It'd be nice. I know I always tell people if I won the Lotto Max, I'd sponsor 30 golfers, you know, up and coming Canadian golfers right away with, you know, what do you guys need to prove on? Where do you need to play? Yeah. Or even start my own tour, just because I've seen so many talented Canadian golfers, including myself, because I felt like I was a world beater that just ran out of money.
I've always said that, you know, the money usually runs out before the talent does, you know, and that we saw that obviously a lot on the tours. You know, how did that affect you even when you think about, you know, you working your way up to the Korn Ferry Tour in 2012? I mean, you had a T6 there, I think was your best finish, but, you know, it's hard to sustain yourself and stay out there for long enough to kind of get your footing under you if you don't have the finances to do it, right?
Right. Well, and hopefully Bill Hughes isn't listening to this or some of the Titleist reps, because I did get a few Circle T Camerons while I was out there playing the Corn Ferry Tour, and they made their way into individuals' hands. There was transactions made. It was an expensive tour to play, and you know, like you said, I did that certain week. I did finish sixth is this week in Springfield at Highlands, and I did have the lead after 63 home out there. My best played Saturday with Casey Wittenberg at the time, and he was number one on the list. Casey was winning everything. Went head to head with him and shot 63 on Saturday, six under the back nine, and then went out Sunday morning, had a putt on the ninth hole to shoot basically 59 in 18 holes, because I was six under the front there after eight. Had the lead and was playing with Brian Stewart. He's on the big tour now. And got to the 12th hole and just made a bad club decision, made a double bogey, and then just kept hitting it good, and the putts were just not falling. And that was it, you know. That was my chance to win. It was a nice week though, because I stayed with a family that was very close to Payne Stewart. And we'll revert back to my college days at Illinois State. We played that golf course against Southwest Missouri State University the week Payne Stewart died. We were on the golf course, and we got pulled off the golf course when his plane went down.
Yeah.
So it was kind of one of those freaky things where I was up there, and special moments that, you know, there's something out there that puts you in a certain place, whether it be fate or belief, whatever it be. That I was in Springfield years after I played a college tournament there and almost won.
Wild. Just a wild connection as far as that's concerned. I mean, you tend to get, I don't know, we'll call it emotional when we talk about golf a fair bit, and life, you know, kind of integrating with golf as well. Why do you think it brings up emotions with you sometimes?
Yeah. As you say that, I got, you know, goosebumps on my arms. I think it's just the game is so good for life. It's, if there was a kid out there that was, you know, the first tee programs, the underprivileged kids, if there was a game that I'd want to teach a kid or get them involved in, it'd be golf. Because there's so many good life lessons. You know, you have your honesty, integrity, your etiquette, personality, you know. There's so many good time management. I'm never going to be late for anything. I'm a golfer.
Sure. That's well said.
You know, you're late, you miss your tee time, you're getting penalized, or you're getting disqualified. But the game itself, if every kid could just play the game and understand it and be taught, obviously, you know, because there is certain etiquettes where I think the new age of golfers, you know, you talked about the 20-foot cart before in one of your podcasts. Just etiquette that's been skipped, but aside from that, it's a game that you can learn so many great life lessons, and kids should really do that. And I do get choked up about talking.
Yeah. No, and that's perfectly fine. I mean, I obviously feel the same way. And, you know, the golf does, you know, when it impacts your life as much as it does, it's hard not to get emotional about it. Are your kids playing? Are they involved in the game in any possible way?
When I don't get to see my kids as much as I'd like. They live on the island out in Victoria, yeah. And I'm in central Alberta here, but I'm going to have them for a couple weeks here coming up in August before they go back to school. And part of it was COVID. I didn't get to see them and whatnot. So
sure.
We'll be out on the driving range. We're still trying to figure out if Coral, my 14-year-old daughter, is a righty or lefty. She can do it good both ways. Son Luke, he's eight. He wants to be a quarterback, so we're not sure about the golf with him, but I just posted a Facebook memory came up of them swinging the club on the range a couple years ago. So we'll get them out on the golf course as soon as they get out here. Cause like I said, you know, if I got to see them more, I'm sure they'd be more involved with the game.
Yeah. One question I have for you, and that's one that, you know, in thinking about, you know, where you're at in Stettler and growing up in Fort McMurray, there's a tendency for a lot of the top pros that are from Canada, especially if we look at, you know, let's look at the Canadians right now. You know, they come from small towns. They're not necessarily from the big city. They're not necessarily from the country clubs. Why do you think there's sort of, I won't say an advantage, but why do you think that is?
I think it's an inner drive. I think a lot of the kids from the small city, maybe they, it's the inner drive and the support they have in the small communities. You know, I know growing up in Fort McMurray, obviously my career didn't really take off much after that, but going back and playing events, you know, just the amount of support in that small town, the small town mentality, they know what you're doing. They know exactly, they can get behind you. And I think that's a big part of it. Cause look at Brooke, you know, Smith Falls, you know, she's an unbelievable talent, you know, Graham Dillette, Weyburn, Saskatchewan, you know, there's the list goes on.
Sure.
What Mackenzie from Dundas, Ontario, and Corey, there's a lot of a great talented kids. And I think it's the support of the community they get, and it helps the drive. I know I was proud to be a kid from Fort McMurray, and I worked my butt off to get in the Sports Hall of Fame there, something I'm proud of.
Yeah, I mean, that is a big honor. And for you, though, I mean, I don't know. I never thought of you a guy that was really chasing accolades or things like that. But, you know, what does a moment like that mean to you to get into that Hall of Fame?
It's really nice. Like you said, I'm not huge on accolades, but it's nice to be recognized, because a lot of people, they don't see the 8 hours standing in the direct sunlight heat out there beating balls on the range. You know, I kind of revert a little back to the whole sponsorship thing of you know, I've sat at so many meetings and business meetings with guys like, I'm not prepared to give you money to go on a golf vacation. Well, it's not a golf vacation. Come out and watch us work, you know, play 9 holes in the morning, hit balls for 6 hours, play another 9 holes, work in a short game. So those accolades are nice, because you know you put the work in and you deserved it. And, you know, I put my financial life into golf.
You know, you're obviously a great guy for this, just because of, obviously, you know, you've had success in your career, and, you know, you're very thoughtful as far as, you know, youth and development and things like that. What would you say to an up and coming golfer right now, if they're a junior golfer, what should they focus or concentrate on if they want to be the best golfer they could possibly be?
Oh, in my eyes, it'd be working on the short game for sure.
Yeah.
Just make putts, you know, and chip and work on that game, because your natural talent of hitting golf balls is, most of the guys can hit it pretty good on tour. It's the guys that are, you know, miss the 3 greens that get it up and down every time. So I myself, it would be short game and having confidence.
So for you, I mean, you managed to play in a lot of countries. I don't know if you kept count of them. You might have. I don't know if you've tracked it. What was your favorite over the years? You mentioned Estonia. Obviously, you know, you had success in South America. You've been all over the place. Mexico lots of times. China. Any favorite ones that you went to, or favorite golf courses?
Wow, there's so many. That's a hard question, Scott, because I played in South Africa too. I had a couple of European tour events over there. And you know what? It's in our home soil, and it wasn't a tour event, but I got out to Cabot Links, and I got to play with my closest friend, Danny Saul, and my caddy at the time, David O'Donovan. I'm not sure whose bag he's on out on tour right now, but he's an Augusta caddy that caddied for me the year I was on the Korn Ferry Tour. I've been to a lot of different countries, but I've never played in Scotland or Ireland. And I felt like that was it for me. I was there. And like I said, I played with my closest friend and a good, my caddy, a good friend as well. And just enjoyed that place. It wasn't a tournament or anything. It was just, we're rolling our rickshaws across the green.
Which is cool. I mean, that's just a fun part about golf. It doesn't need to be a tournament to be something attractive, right?
People always ask your favorite foursome. Well, I think I've already had my favorite foursome. You know, I played with my sister and my dad and my mom together. Like, sure, it'd be nice to play with Tiger and Phil and whoever you want to name for a fourth. But, you know, family's important. And I didn't get to where I was in my career without my family, too, because I have to mention their support. Parents, my sister, and my grandmother, my aunt, you know, my Auntie Debbie was my biggest fan. She went to Spain. She went to China. Both.
Wow.
So, yeah. That's she had crazy. A thing for Sergio, so she had to go.
I love that. Here's an interesting one for you, because again, you know, you crossed a few generations, and you know, besides looking in the mirror and saying yourself, two things. Who's the best or the most talented golfer that you probably played with who maybe didn't make it? And who do you think the most talented golfer is that you played with that did make it? And I say make it as far as, you know, to achieve a high levels of success that maybe, you know, the LPGA or PGA tour.
Right.
Or European tour, whatever the case may be.
Yeah. Well, I think we've got to look in Alberta here right now for one of the most talented guys I've ever played with, in Wes Heffernan.
Yeah. Stripe show. A literal stripe show.
Yeah. Wesley Pipes, call him. Because obviously, you know, we know it's been documented, the story about him playing the US Open and the comments that were made. And I think it was Fred Couples that actually said it, you know, about Wes. He said, this guy's the best player in the field and he doesn't even know it. And I'm sorry, Wes, but I'm going to say this, but I know the fire, it just didn't seem like it was there for him. To me, it just looked like he didn't have the fire. Well, and he just shot 7-under in a Alberta PGA. And he's still got the game. And, yeah. You know, he plays when he can. He has a family now, and I understand that. And his wife's in the business. They have their own golf set up together. So, and then the guy that did make it was Graham. You know, obviously he didn't get that win, but after playing with him, you know, 2005 to 2009, I told his dad, I said, you know, Canada's looking for the next Mike Weir, and your son is it. And man, he just didn't quite get that win, but he was there so many times, and just a talent, like, unfortunately, hurting wise, is back, whatnot. You know, he played hockey as a kid and did some things to injure himself. But man, he was a talent, ball striker. You know, I considered myself really good, a world beater in ball striking. But Graham can hit it as well. You know, and that's the thing with Canadians. I look back. You know, look at Knutson. Look at Dave Barr. Look at some of our past golfers that were such great ball strikers that just didn't quite get it there, you know.
Yeah.
Obviously, Dave Barr, Dan Holerson as well. You know, he's close to my heart. I always get choked up when I talk about Dan, but he did a lot for the Canadian Tour, and we got to respect those guys that led the way. In Fort McMurray, I think back. I have a beta tape. I need to find someone I can change a beta tape.
Well, maybe somebody will be listening to this podcast and be able to help you out. The one person.
Exactly. But there was a skins game. Yeah, there was like the Labatt. I don't know if it was Labatt or whoever the sponsor was, but a skins game coming up to Fort McMurray. Dave Barr, Dan Holerson. I think Nelford might have been there a year or two as well. Okay. And then we had the Canadian Tour event. Like,
yeah.
This was... So it would be 88, 89, the two events up there, already classic. But I caddied for Kelly Gibson.
Wow.
And his ping bag was just slight underneath my eye level at the time. But another great story. Caddied for him in Fort McMurray. Let's fast forward to the Corn Ferry Tour. He's out in Kansas City in the locker room. I see him there, and I have a picture of me carrying his bag for Maria. So I got my mom to text it to me or whatnot. And I went up to him in the locker room and said, "Hey, Kelly, I don't think you'll remember me, but I have this picture when you were in Fort McMurray, Alberta. Do you think you could take an updated picture with me in the locker room here?" And he did. And, you know, it was a good conversation. So, and getting back to Dan Hollerson and the Skins game, that opened my eyes. That kind of was a determining factor going, I could do this for a living. As much as I wanted to be a pro hockey player as a kid.
Didn't quite make the Oilers.
Yeah, the move to Arizona kind of spoiled that. That was before the Coyotes. I didn't even take my hockey equipment down there. So golf was, it went from one to play professional hockey to be a professional golfer.
You know, you mentioned Barr, Halderson, those guys were, I mean, before that event went there, you know, who were your golf heroes? Who did you look up to?
We had a pro in Fort McMurray, and you might, I don't know if you remember the name, but Mark Shushak.
Okay, yeah.
He was a pro's pro. He was a club pro that you don't see anymore. In the golf industry, the golf industry's changed by far anyways, but you don't – Mark would just, he'd be at the golf course and he'd go to the range and he'd say, "Hey, Mr. Anderson, how are you doing today? Hey, Mr. Smith, how are you?" And you're like, "What are you working on?" You know, just stop and chat with them, give them a little tip and just move on. He was one guy for sure. And then obviously competing against my dad, he kind of had to swallow his words. He said at a very young age when my sister and I were playing, if the day that we beat him, he would buy us a vehicle.
Wow. And what age was that?
That happened. Yeah. That age was, I want to say that age happened 12, 13.
Wow.
So fast forward into Arizona, not until I was, I believe, 20 at the time. No, it would have been 18, 19.
Okay.
I got a Honda Civic.
Nice. So he made good, which is nice.
You know, he made up his word. He made good for sure, but yeah, he definitely he made that comment early. And a nice, you know, with my sister being competitive for 2009 was great because she got to play in the Canadian Women's Open in Edmonton at Mayfair because at the time that's where she was working.
Okay.
And I played the 2009 at Glen Abbey. So it was a good thing for our family. You know, we have the flags and whatnot and the pictures. And so that's another great family story that, you know, not too many families can tell.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, not many people get to play in the National Opens, let alone their sister as well or their sibling, right?
Yeah.
You know, when you project ahead now, obviously, you know, you've got some goals as far as from a playing wise, you know, what other things do you want to do in golf? What other elements do you want? I mean, you mentioned not going to Scotland and Ireland yet. You haven't played there. Do you still have other visions of things that you want to do around the game?
Well, there's been so many opportunities with the game. And actually, a couple of years ago, I decided to get my referee status. So I'm a level 3 certified referee. So I'm going to do some McLennan Ross Jr. events here in Alberta later in August. I did a senior qualifier for Alberta Golf last year and contacted Golf Canada and got my name on the list. It all came about talking with, a little bit with Scott Pritchard, but more of Cam Crawford when he was running the McKenzie Tour, that they're always looking for officials. And it's kind of a streamline to the PGA Tour, you know, aside from being a caddy, you know, being around the game, I want to be around the game and whatever level that is, I've kind of got a few different avenues right now. Obviously playing golf is the goal, but I can take a back burner to coaching some juniors and teaching and spreading my experiences with the game, or even, you know, being a rules official, because, you know, the caddy is a nice job, but I kind of want to
You want to swing the clubs.
Yeah.
So what's your schedule look like? I mean, what are your plans now? I mean, you said you're going to kind of work your way into it. You've got some time here. You know, you've playing some stuff. You play the Alberta Open. Where do you see your schedule kind of in the next couple years or so?
Well, hopefully, as I guess COVID opens up, it might change with the Mackenzie Tour being sign up only. But my plan was to play at least two of the four out west here, play Calgary and Victoria. Victoria being the most important because my kids, you know, playing in front of them, but Calgary being close to home. I'd love to go to Waskasoo and play Elk Ridge. You know, I have a good couple buddies there. Ryan Danberg's the GM and Ryan Wells is the pro there. So, you know, I know some people in that northern Saskatchewan area because of the Prince Albert fundraiser we did. And so I'd like to play all four of those. Work said they'd allow me to do it. After my recent golf on the course recently, I've kind of narrowed it back maybe just to play the two and work.
That's not like you to be shy. Come on.
Well, it is what it is. I signed my card. A lot of guys probably wouldn't, you know.
Yeah.
Kind of like the Smiley Kaufman thing recently. You got to give. I'm not one to quit, and golf's golf. You're going to have those rounds where just you shoot a freak score. I'm not going to complain that my rib muscle's been bothering me for 2 months, which it has. But no, just baby steps. Like I said, I want to improve my game to where 3-4 years down the road, before the Champions Tour deadline, that I might have status, whether it be Mackenzie or Corn Ferry or all else fails, the PGA Tour. You never know. You know, you can say this to anybody. All it takes is one good week.
Fantastic. You know what? You've never been a quitter in your life, and I've always respected that. And, you know, the fact that you're getting back to it is certainly going to be a very positive thing, I would think. And I'm just excited that, you know, the game is still in your life and that you're willing to give back to the game as well. So it's been great to chat with you. I know we'll catch up more, but I appreciate you coming on the show. Wishing you the best of luck with all your endeavors. And I know a lot of people will be following, listening, and supporting.
Yeah. Thanks, Scott. Well, I appreciate it. You know, you've been really good. You know, that I don't know how many views of the Cheesecake Long Drive.
We didn't even get into that. Should we tell that story before we go?
That's a great story. Okay, all right. Well, every year playing the Canadian Tour, Lee Curry, Brad Fritch would put a great pro-am. The members at Riverview Golf Club, Paul Sherritt, the pro, everyone involved in that event, you know, from my billets, I stayed with Robert and Brandy Hill, Carmine, you know, there's so many good people there. But anyways, it's a pro-am. They have a long drive after the event, and all the members get around, all the people involved playing in the event. And I like to entertain. I think the people that are paying for us to be there and putting up the sponsorship money deserve a show. So me being the entertainer, I always tried to come up with new ideas for this long drive every year. There was some good cheesecake the one year and decided that I was going to drive it off Cheesecake, and didn't have a whole lot of time to plan the whole scene, but missed the first drive left. Decided, well, I needed some energy, so took a bite of the cheesecake and missed that one left, and then decided to have my after-dinner mint, is like I called it, which cigarette. I'm proud to say I'm smoke-free now.
Oh, very nice.
Cigarette, yeah. It's been difficult, especially around the game this summer, but I'm glad I made that healthy decision, and it's all done. But, yeah, it was that event was great for us because it was a little cash influx. You played well. You got a good check.
I think it was
10 grand for the winner at times. So us guys, we're praying that we'd get an invite to that event. Fortunately, I did I got, and I made sure I got out there because the people involved, Carmine, he bought me a putter the one year. Actually, the story of Montreal Open started at Riverview. I started the week before Montreal. I went into the shop and I was struggling, having my usual putting woes. But I went into the shop and picked a putter out, and Paul was in there, and Tim, the pro shop, they set me up with a putter, and lo and behold, went out and shot 21 under that next week in Montreal, won the event. And then the following year, a member through the event said, well, what kind of putter do you need this year? You need to win another event. So he went in and bought me a putter at the pro shop.
That's crazy. So, yeah.
And then just the kindness of all those people, like there was big money involved in the Calcutta and the team aspect. And most of the time the pros got it in their pocket. Like the amateurs that were betting on the team, they're like, here, I know you need this more than me. And
yeah.
If we could see that more in golf, it comes back to the sponsorship. I think we'd have a lot more Canadians on the big tour.
100%. You know, there's a lot of good people in the game, but we definitely need to support our athletes if we want to see them have success. They just don't get it overnight, and they just don't get it automatically. We have to have a responsibility to help make that happen, right? Awesome. Well, thank you again. Appreciate it. And I know we could go on for hours.
We could. I could spend, but I do. I should probably get to work myself.
Yeah, for sure. And hey, you know what? Certainly Dry Island, who you work for, has been very supportive. You know, but yeah, get back to work and we'll catch up soon, I'm sure.
Okay. Thanks, Scotty. Take care.
All right, y'all. Thank you for listening. Thank you, Stuart Anderson, for the interview. We appreciate a lot of good stories from a four-time Canadian Tour winner there. Thank you, Brandon Kennedy, for the edits, as per usual. Scotty, thank you. And all the listeners, thank you. We'll be back next week. We'll break down the Olympics then. Can't wait. Chat with you then.